What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, The Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology, now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with a city on edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorindi returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Dawn Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detectives shaken, to find the South Side Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, The Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, The Scare, on Prime Video, now streaming.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This week on Hometown Ghost Stories. In 1989, paranormal investigators responded to a woman's claims that her small home was being haunted by at least two ghosts. The apparition of a corpse-like old man and a disembodied head that manifested in her attic. It wouldn't be long before the team would collect some of the most insane evidence of paranormal activity within the bungalow. This is Hometown Ghost Stories, the poltergeist of San Pedro, California.
Hometown Ghost Stories contains serious and often distressing events and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
It was a clear spring night in San Pedro, California. The year was 1989, and it was the kind of night that Jackie typically would have enjoyed back when things were normal. But things hadn't been normal, and lately, Jackie felt like she was losing her mind. She locked the car and trotted up the steps to her house. She could hear her two-year-old crying before she even opened the door and wondered what madness was occurring to cause the tantrum. A toddler crying shouldn't be anything out of the ordinary. But when you live in a haunted house, ordinary isn't the first thing that comes to mind. Jackie opened the door and found Christina, the babysitter, trying to console her two-year-old son Jamie, who was sitting on the floor surrounded by a bowl of spilled cereal. Turns out it was just an ordinary toddler issue after all. "How'd everything go today?" Jackie asked, as she walked over to the sink full of dishes. Christina told her that it was a relatively uneventful day, except that the cat had been acting funny, chasing around and hissing at something that didn't seem to exist. Christina joined Jackie at the sink, and the two went to work washing and drying dishes while Jamie sat quietly in his high chair. Jackie was about to ask about the baby, who she assumed was napping, when she noticed that familiar putrid smell that had been making its presence more frequently. "There it is again," she blurted out in frustration. Earlier that week, she had pest control come out and search for a dead animal, but to no avail. Christina nodded toward the wall and said, "I think it's coming from that." There was a strange red substance oozing from the wall. Jackie leaned in and gave the ooze a cursory sniff. She immediately reeled back, gagging. "Yup, that's it," she choked. The two assessed the situation and agreed that whatever was oozing from the wall must be coming from above. Jackie asked Christina to stay with Jamie while she went to investigate. She figured there may be some sort of an animal that got trapped in the attic and died there. She opened the hatch and climbed into the attic. Her unease intensified. The attic creeped her out. To be fair, all attics creeped her out. But there seemed to be something forbidding about her attic in particular. Not to mention the unsettling possibility of finding a dead animal up there. She poked her head into the attic and tried to focus her eyes so she could adjust to the darkness. As they did, Jackie let out a scream. There in front of her was the disembodied head of a gnarled old man glaring back at her. His eyes glowed a milky white, and she could make out the gaping creases in his seemingly ancient skin. The head looked so real that she thought it might just open its mouth and speak, but she didn't give it a chance. She dropped back down through the hole onto the washing machine and slammed the hatch shut. I'm Jesse Wilkins, and this is Hometown Ghost Stories, the Poltergeist of San Pedro, California. San Pedro, California, 1989. After a rocky marriage, Jackie Hernandez was ready to start the next chapter of her life. She moved into a new home with her son, which was a bungalow in San Pedro, California. Little did she know, this would be the beginning of a nightmare that would carry on for years. Almost immediately after moving into the new house, Jackie noticed that something just wasn't right. She began to think that her home might be haunted. And it became apparent that whatever entity was haunting the home was not shy, as it did not hesitate to make its presence known. Jackie was pregnant with her daughter at the time. She was juggling the tasks of raising her son, working multiple jobs, and attending school. She was stressed out, but tried to remain optimistic during the process. The paranormal activity in the home began with moving objects, odd smells, and disembodied voices. The hauntings quickly escalated. Within days, the activity within the home went from odd to something straight out of a horror movie. One night, she entered Jamie's room and witnessed a full-bodied apparition of a decrepit old man looming over her child. The spirit gave her a frightening glare before vanishing into thin air. The terrifying encounter would only be the beginning of the nightmare to come, as the spirit would soon make its violent intentions known. Jackie reached out to her neighbor Susan and explained all of the horrific, unexplainable occurrences that were going on inside of her home. During one of Susan's visits, a loud crash was heard coming from the kitchen. They quickly rushed in to see what had happened. They saw a painting had been ripped off of the wall and now leaned up against the sink. The force of the painting being ripped from the wall had pulled out the nails. The nails were now lying on the ground, pointed upwards on the floor, almost as if whatever ripped out the painting had laid a trap with the intention of harming whoever walked into the kitchen next. Luckily, they saw the nails before anyone stepped on them. While this experience shook Jackie and Susan to the core, this almost came as a relief to Jackie, as for the first time in over a year, she was not the only one to witness paranormal activity within the home. In an odd way, this temporarily put her mind at ease, as now she felt that all of this was not in her own head, and she wasn't going crazy. Eventually, babysitters, friends, and family would all witness poltergeist activity inside the bungalow, and the list of witnesses grew. Jackie began documenting paranormal events inside the home, which ranged from foul-smelling liquid that would materialize in the kitchen to glowing orbs and balls of light from no known source. It became clear that all of the activity seemed to be centered around the attic. This was reassured when Jackie traced a blood-like substance that had been oozing into her kitchen, almost sweating from the walls. She followed the trail of blood, which led up to the attic. When she opened the hatch, she witnessed a disembodied head, which resembled the same entity that she had seen in her son's room. With the hauntings getting worse, Susan reached out to paranormal investigators for help on Jackie's behalf. Dr. Barry Taft, who was the associate director of the parapsychology lab at UCLA and a veteran investigator, responded and agreed to help find out what was really going on at the home. Taft brought on a camera crew, Jeff Wheatcraft and Barry Conrad, in hopes to capture evidence of the haunting on film, as well as Larry Brooks, who was an artist brought in to draw pictures of the different scenes inside the home. On their initial walkthrough, Jeff, who was a hardcore skeptic at the time, made his way towards the attic and reported that he felt as though something was watching him up there. Larry suggested that they go back into the attic and snap some pictures to see if they could find anything. Jeff's plan was to snap pictures over his shoulder to see if he could catch something manifesting behind him. He fired his first, then second photo. As he went to snap the third picture, he felt something grab his camera and yank it out of his hands. Shocked, he ran back downstairs, but after realizing that he left his expensive camera in the attic, he knew he had to make his way back up. When he returned, the lens of the camera was in one corner of the room, while the body of the camera sat 15 feet away in the opposite corner. It was sitting upside down inside of a box. Whatever had taken it from his hands had separated the lens from the body of the camera, which had to be removed by twisting the lock of the friction mount lens. Jeff was now convinced that there had to be something unexplainable up in the attic. Later that evening, Jeff and Conrad went back into the attic to film the room. Immediately after entering the attic, the camera's battery died. As he went downstairs, it fired back up as if nothing was ever wrong. Up and down he would go, and each time, the battery would die as soon as they entered the attic. Shortly after, Jeff felt what he described as a huge hand that pushed him on the back. Conrad witnessed the attack. He couldn't see what was pushing him despite having a 1,000-watt light pointed directly at him. Jackie claimed that she was familiar with this sensation, and she too had been pushed while in the same area of the house on multiple occasions. Jeff and Conrad came down from the attic, where Jeff had also reported that he saw strange lights darting around. It was clear that whatever lurked in the attic was targeting Jeff, who witnessed a giant shadow and even captured a photograph of the strange light anomaly. The entire group congregated in the kitchen, and that's when they all heard heavy footsteps stomping around directly above them. Jeff stood up on the washing machine to have a look inside the attic again, and he saw three more flashes of lights. The third flash was considerably larger than the other two, about the size of a basketball. He once again saw the shadow figure. He described it as a large dark mass, about the size of three men covered in a black cloak, which moved slowly across the attic before it disappeared. A few weeks later, Jackie was assaulted and placed a frantic call to Barry Taft for help. Jackie claimed that she was hit by a can of Coke that flew across the room and hit her in the back. Items continued to fly at her as she was on the phone talking to Barry. Taft gathered his group of investigators, and they returned to the home. They were all uneasy about going back into the attic, but nobody predicted what would happen next. As Jeff entered the attic, he reported that nothing was really happening and approached the opening. Conrad made his way up with his camera. Just then, Jeff let out a scream and dropped the flashlight. The attic went dark. Conrad couldn't see much, but since Jeff was wearing a white shirt, he could see that Jeff was standing at about a 45-degree angle. He found this odd, as he was standing in an unnatural position. Jeff felt something around his neck, and everything went black for him. A clothesline had been tied around his neck, and he was strung from a nail in the attic ceiling. The look on his face was completely blank. Without a flashlight in hand, Conrad's first instinct was to snap a picture, as the flash from the camera was the only source of light that he had. They had documented and filmed everything in the attic, and there was no sign of a clothesline before the hanging occurred. Had Jeff been alone in the attic, he probably would have been killed from this attack. Next seemed like a direct threat to Jackie's newborn baby, Samantha. Sue noticed a red mark on the baby's forehead. It seemed like this may have been a message from the entity that was letting Jackie know that not even her children were safe. The child was unharmed and unfazed, but this reminded Jackie of the blood that had been dripping from the walls, and she wiped the mark away as quickly as possible, just as she had when she cleaned up the blood-like substance in the kitchen. Jackie and her husband, Al, got back together and decided it was time to move on. They moved into a trailer in Weldon. Not long after moving into the new residence, the couple split up again. One of Jackie's neighbors was helping move a TV out of her shed when she noticed a glaring face of a withered, elderly spirit. It became clear that whatever was haunting the home in San Pedro had followed her to her new home. From that day on, the entity's spirit was felt by Jackie and others. One evening, she heard knocks and bangs coming from the shed as if something was trying to get out. She once again placed a call to Taft, who came by and set up a camera on a tripod pointed directly into the shed. They returned to the house, and after about 15 or 20 minutes, they looked outside and noticed that the camera had shifted positions and now was pointed directly at them. The camera's position had been locked, and it would have been impossible for it to shift on its own. With their equipment constantly malfunctioning, Jackie kept a transcript as they tried other methods to communicate with the ghosts. Jackie said that through a Ouija board, the spirit had told her that he had been suffocated in the San Pedro Inlet in 1930, and his killer resided in her old house. He also told her that there were more spirits residing in the home as well. The ghost admitted that he had tried to hang cameraman Jeff Wheatcraft because he looked like his killer. During another Ouija board session, Jeff was lifted a few feet into the air and levitated for a moment before getting thrown against the wall of the trailer. He felt like he was hit by, quote, a huge boxing glove. He immediately left the trailer. Once he was outside, he claimed that something was compelling him to go back in. Once he re-entered the building, everything seemed normal, except for the temperature. It was freezing cold for the rest of the night inside. In the following weeks, Tina Lawler, a babysitter hired by Jackie, witnessed what appeared to be a face that had been burned into a bedspread. She also noticed red slashes that would appear on the walls. Sometimes, they would even spell out Jackie's name. She said that Jackie was so used to this paranormal phenomena that she would just paint right over the marks that would appear on her walls. The babysitter also noticed a skull that appeared in one of the camera lenses. Tina dropped the camera and ran. One evening, Tina joined Barry and his team for another Ouija board session inside the trailer. They set up their camera with the Ouija board and the candles. The camera went dead as usual, and the planchette started flying around the board without anyone touching it. The candles were constantly being blown out and relighting themselves. Jeff slumped forward in his chair for a moment. As that happened, the Ouija board spelled out Jeff's name. His chair then slid back and flew against the wall. The board then told them that it was targeting the baby and did not like Jeff. That night, when Tina went to bed, she took a crucifix with her and laid it next to the nightstand. When she woke up, the cross had been moved and the figurine of Jesus had been removed altogether. They assumed that Jesus had just gotten knocked over until they discovered it hanging from the railing outside of Jackie's bedroom. The next Ouija board session was the same story. Whenever the sun went down, the cameras would die. When the sun came back up, they would power back up on cue. Whatever this entity was that they were dealing with was powerful, intelligent, and dangerous. Every member of Barry's team, skeptic and believer, experienced paranormal activity in this case. The evidence collected is some of the most controversial in the history of hauntings, but every investigator, family member, and friend involved in this case swears that there was something evil going on that was following Jackie and clearly targeting Jeff. After these Ouija board sessions, the haunting began to die down. It seemed that after the seances, whatever was following Jackie seemed to either be at peace or move on. In a final twist, years later, while visiting San Pedro, Jackie saw an orb of light take off from her old home and rest in a graveyard. She followed the orb, and it circled around the grave of a man named John Damon. As they dug through the archives and looked up the old records in the house, there was a man who died in the home by the name of John Damon. Quote, "In the darkness, something had grabbed onto his feet and wrapped a washing line around his neck, then strung him up to a nail in the rafters. If Gary hadn't lifted him up and unwound the cord, he would have been the first ever victim of a spectral lynching. In fact, Jeff very nearly didn't make it. While Gary was trying to lift his friend up by the waist to get some slack and loosen the cord, the entity was pulling at Jeff's legs to tighten the noose. At the last moment, Gary bent the nail with his bare hands so the cord would come loose. Jeff had blacked out when the noose tightened, but he came to when the cord was loosened, and it was then that he felt something pulling on his legs. Incredible as it must sound, the evidence was there on film for all to see in the shape of angry red welts around Jeff's neck." I'm Jesse Wilkins, and this is Hometown Ghost Stories, The Poltergeist of San Pedro. What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome into Hometown Ghost Stories, episode 115, The Poltergeist of San Pedro. I'm Jesse Wilkins. I'm joined by Rob Coakley. Hello, Rob.
Now, I know we don't make the rules, but after 115 episodes, we're going to make one. And that rule is your investigation team cannot be named people like Barry, Barry, Larry, Mary, Carrie, Jerry. Like, there was too much going on. How do you follow this story?
You actually forgot Gary. So there literally was. And Gary. It was two Barrys, Larry and Gary. And the most complicated thing with this whole case while investigating it was all of the sources got all of the names wrong. So they were calling Barry Taft, Barry Taft. They were calling Wheatcraft, Wheatcraft. I had to go back and like re-edit it, like, because I was reading some of the wrong names and they were getting it confused. Was Barry in the attic with Larry, or was it Gary with Gary? Was Barry with the other Barry at the time, or was it Jeff? Thank you, Jeff, for being named Jeff.
That's why he was targeted. It's the only one the ghost can pick out.
He's like, I don't know who everybody else is, but I know who Jeff is.
I can figure
out. Speaking of Jeff, we're joined by Jeff Wilkins. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
I just wanted
to actually congratulate you on your opening story and your correct use of the word forbidding.
Good. Because like I said, I am Ron Burgundy and I will just read what's on the paper. So it could have been foreboding, but I think forbidding is actually the correct term to use there. So I always trust your writing. But we're here. Episode 115. That was the San Pedro haunting. Now, San Pedro by some locals is called San Pedro. So before people come and attack me for the mispronunciation of the word mispronunciation and the mispronunciation of the word Pedro or Pedro. It seems like most people say it one way or the other. Me, I mean, I grew up, my favorite baseball player is Pedro Martinez. So I see that word, I say Pedro. I don't know. But maybe the correct way to say it is Pedro. There's a full documentary. And I know a few people in chat were calling out, because this is a very controversial case. A few people were calling up like, this is nonsense. Why wasn't this on film? Why wasn't that on film? A lot of this is on film. What I took out of this, because I didn't want to get hit with copyright for literally just ripping a documentary and including the footage, we didn't have permission to use it. So I used screenshots from it, which we probably don't have permission to use either, but we went for the pictures. But we're an educational show. I think there's loopholes here. There's a reason our channel's still around for now. But a lot of this is on film. So you can go check out the documentary. It's called An Unknown Encounter. This was released back in the 90s. It's very 90s, so get ready for some animations that will not scare you, but the story is insane, and we'll get into the details of it. But multiple witnesses. Had I realized how similar this story is to the Entity House case, I probably would have spaced him out a little bit, because I covered the Entity case like a month or two ago. And this one, not only was it a very similar story where you had kind of a single mom under stress dealing with a haunting in her house, she calls in Barry Taft and literally the same paranormal investigation team, but there's a lot of this that checks out. And a lot of this was backed by science, and we'll dive into the hauntings and everything.
Yeah. And another one that we focus on location a lot, right? Like, because that's where we start. We start with the town, but this haunting is an attachment haunting, it appears to be, where it actually followed the family, which we don't get frequently. So it's, this one is different than a lot of the cases that we cover in that aspect.
It is different. And one of the things that I left out was a lot of the hauntings that followed the investigators as well, because it didn't just follow Jackie, it followed members of the team as well. And they also have documentation of a lot of the hauntings that happened at their apartments and stuff. And some of these hauntings are absolutely insane too. But we try to keep these things under 20 minutes. This one could have gone longer, but
it's interesting that they classify it as a poltergeist case, where I feel like this really aligns with a lot more demonic cases that we've seen.
Yeah.
One with the entity attaching itself to the people and following them to different locations. That's not something you typically see in a poltergeist. And you don't really see as much of it throwing things around or moving objects so much as it is just attacking people.
Unless you count the Coke can.
A lot of this stuff does look like poltergeist activity. You do wonder, because there were multiple spirits in the house. So one of them could have been a poltergeist. That could have been something more evil or demonic there as well. But things are getting moved. There's a ton of footage, not just pictures, but video footage of orbs. And they have these weird shapes that you don't usually get. So usually you're trying to debunk orbs. Is it dust? Is it an insect? These ones have like almost pea pod kind of shapes, where there's like three or four different bumps to it. And they're kind of zooming in and out of frame, but they're moving at a path that an insect wouldn't take. Usually insects are much more sporadic, where they're kind of up and down and looping around and all this stuff. These ones are going in like straight lines, dashing across the screen. It's definitely something strange. And all of this footage was analyzed by professionals, and they brought a lot of men on that documentary, and they were unable to debunk it as anything natural. So
how long have you been an insectologist is my question.
I got the degree at the same time I was going for the nuclear physicist stuff.
Yeah, so they correlate, right?
Like, I think the scientific term is bugologist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Fair.
Absolutely. So thank you for clearing that up. But yeah, it's there's so much to this case. So let's start with the blood. So she had noticed this kind of blood plasma that was dripping, and it seemed to be sweating from the walls, and it was leaking down. It was inside the cabinets. It was going around like the cups and the plates inside the cabinets, everything like that. And they couldn't quite figure out what it was. So, and it had a weird smell to it. And investigators, when they first got to the house, they said they had the scent of iodine, which I can't tell you what that smells like off the top of my head, but it was a clear scent. And everyone's like, that's a weird smell to be here. So they actually took a sample of that blood plasma, or that red ooze that was coming out of the wall, and they sent it into a lab, and the lab analyzed it, and they took multiple samples, and it came back as part human blood, part iodine, and part some other chemical. But they identified the blood as male blood. Insane. Like, where is this coming? Why is there blood seeping through your walls? So it's like, is there a body stashed somewhere in your house? Like, what is the scientific explanation for this? Plus, it's male blood. There were no grown men living in the house. So it's a weird wrinkle in this story that unless the investigators are putting it in there, I don't know, but this was happening.
She found it before the investigators showed up.
Yep. So she had an on and off again relationship with her husband, Al. Al also experienced some hauntings. So he had something was whispered in his ear, like something along the lines of like, nobody in this house is safe or something like that. And it was so clear that he responded. He's like, what do you mean? And then like, he realized nobody was there. And that was kind of the only haunting that happened there. After he left the picture again, there was another haunting that I didn't include because it was just so goofy. Some of the hauntings in this are, but if they're real, then it's insane. But it was written on one of the walls, like all over the wall in crayon, was L over and over and over and over and over again. One letter in red and one letter in blue. And it was kind of a strange thing to happen, but they chalked it up to paranormal activity. Jackie swore that she couldn't do it. It didn't look like kids' handwriting, so it probably wasn't one of the kids. It definitely wasn't the baby, but it maybe could have been the two-year-old or three-year-old, however old he was at the time. So
I think the blood is another thing that suggests more demonic than poltergeist. Things like that you see in the infestation stages and some of the oppression stages of demonic possessions. And it's not something, you don't really see stuff like that in poltergeist cases. Poltergeist kind of move things around. They're not creating physical anomalies like manifesting blood and things like that I know of. At least, I mean, I guess this case would be an example of one doing that, but to me, it just sounds more demonic than poltergeist.
Yes. So I think Nancy was asking in chat about how can you tell if sex can be determined from a blood smear? You can. The distribution histogram of AC in women shows a multimodal histogram contrary to men's graph, which is a bell-shaped curve. So
yeah, crazy that you just knew that off the top of your head.
That was really impressive. I was getting ready to say that if you'd just given me like half a second. I was going to get into the bell curve and the histogram.
That's right. Yeah. If there's blood experts out there, please don't leave us 1-star review. I just Googled that quickly.
How dare you?
That's what they said in the documentary. I'm going off a lot of that kind of stuff. But so the hauntings with Al, that's kind of like the end of it with Al. So he was in the picture very briefly. It sounds like they just had a rocky marriage. But the team, they said that like a lot of these hauntings were very spaced out. Now, when you get it all condensed like that into a, you know, 15 to 20 minute breakdown like we did there, if you watch a 1-hour, 1.5-hour long documentary on it, it seems like this is just the most haunted house of all time. And it's probably nonsense, right? That's kind of your first thing, like, oh, these guys are all just whack jobs. But they were saying that they would go days and you know, hours and hours without anything happening. There was quieter nights, there were louder nights, and this went on for years. And, you know, they kept in contact with her, and she would put in calls when things were going particularly crazy, and they'd see if they could go and respond to the scenes. But when they get there, they initially were catching some strange lights. They had heard some weird noises. They all heard footsteps, and they got a general feeling that something was up in the attic. Now, Jeff claimed that he was a hardcore skeptic before this investigation, and obviously everything seemed to be targeting him, or it seemed to be centered around him and the baby, and obviously with the woman as well in the house. So that was pretty clear there. And then obviously his mind changed, but he said when he went up in the attic, he felt something like something was watching him, and he didn't really want to go back up there. And Jackie let him know, like, hey, listen, that's where the hauntings are mostly centered. Then they start seeing shadow figures moving around. They start catching orbs left and right all over the place. Most of this documentary is orbs and these strange light anomalies that keep popping up all over this house, in the attic, all over the house too. And it wasn't just limited to nighttime. Now the most...
The one I found interesting was the shadow that would move around the house and the cat would chase it, which means... the cat seeing it also. You can't fake a cat seeing something, right? Like you can, you can assume that you might be imagining seeing something or that your eyes are playing tricks on you. But if your cat is chasing that shadow, you know that it's actually there.
Yeah, we know that cats are not going to go along with any of your shenanigans ever. Maybe no, you can get your dog to, but your cat is going to call you on your bullshit like 10 times out of 10. So
good point.
Yeah. What I want to go back to real quick is you talking about like people that are just like dismissing this as a hoax. And I understand that perspective, right? Because it's so fantastical. There's so much more evidence here than 99% of cases, but I think that's also sort of a like sort of a cop out in the sense that are we going to just dismiss every time we get like hardcore evidence, right? Because like that's your first mind is to go to skepticism. At least mine is. I know yours is as well, Dave and Jesse. But like, I think we still have to approach it with an open mind, because if you're like just going into it, like I call bullshit, this is definitely fake. If we ever do capture evidence like this, right? Like you're just going to be like, nope, didn't happen at all.
This up. Recently, we were talking about it because it's like we're always demanding evidence. Like, I won't be convinced unless I see compelling evidence. And then every time compelling evidence is presented, we're like, it's obviously fake.
Right. I mean, this is a little bit different, but I had on, what is it, the World News Tonight with David Muir or whatever it is. I was just caught the opening of that the other day, and he's like, a bus crashed in New Zealand. And we think that alien technology is actually being used on the Earth. And then he went into something else. And I'm just like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, how is that not just like something we're spending 2 hours on? If there's like evidence that we're using alien technology and you're putting it on like the actual news. So it's just like, we get to this point where as like a society, we're like almost like conditioned to just cast stuff off. That's just so far advanced for our brain that it's like bullshit, or we're just like, eh, I don't believe it, and then just move on, right? Instead of actually taking the time to be like, well, let me see what this is and if I actually believe that this is true.
Soph brings up a point. She says actually that's called the scientific method, which is a good point, because it's not like you present scientists with something that you consider evidence and they just take it at face value, like, oh, that's it. They test it and try and falsify it. That is literally the scientific method.
Yeah, but we stop at the that's bullshit part, right? Like that's where we stop at. So it's not the scientific method. It's the I ain't got time for this method.
Oh, right. God, just immediately dismissing it, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the evidence, I mean, it's such a controversial case. I still don't know what I believe on this. I think it's another one of those cases where there's so many witnesses and there is a lot of it on camera. That I think I believe some of it, and I think part of it might have been everybody getting in their own heads. I do think they believe what they saw. They seem like they're all true to their word, but I think maybe some of the things were just everybody hyping each other up, and it was just kind of a what's the term when a whole group is going crazy at the same time?
Mass hysteria.
Yeah, a little bit of mass hysteria might have been going on with some of these things, but other things were undeniable, and a lot of it is on camera. So I would suggest, if you haven't, go check out the documentary. Buckle up. It's a 90s documentary. And I thought the guy who narrated this thing was absolutely phenomenal. He like had this, like, he had this, I think he was a British guy, and he had this like little fancy mustache, and he was just so over the top with his narration. I was like, damn, we could learn a thing or two from this guy. He's badass.
it's worth a watch if you want to get some more answers on this case. But yeah, it kept evolving from there. Obviously, if this were laid out and if this were planned out, the end of the story would have been the hanging, right? But the hanging was like the second thing that happened. So we could jump into that because yeah, this is...
Well, please, let's do, because I want to talk about
it. Right. This. I remember seeing this documentary years ago before we were even doing any kind of paranormal stuff. I just always enjoyed this subject. And I remember seeing that picture. I'm like, bro, what a clown. Like, get down from there. What are you doing? You know, it was just...
That's also my initial thought.
When I first saw it, I was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. But if you listen to the witness testimony from it, and there was people in chat that are like, why the hell weren't cameras rolling up here? Why don't you have cameras rolling everywhere? They didn't have a video camera up there at the time. He was up there with a flashlight, which was the only source of light. And apparently it was Gary. So I think Gary was the photographer who actually snapped that picture of him. They hear him scream and he's up there by himself, or Gary was like just about to climb up. There's no ladder up to this attic. It was something where it's like one of those just doors that you open, and they had to like stand on the washing machine and then hoist themselves up to get into there. That was kind of the scenario that you had. So it wasn't so easy just to get up and down. But so Jeff is up there. He's going around with his flashlight. He screams and drops the flashlight. So there's no source of light. The entire attic went dark. So when Gary was up there, he didn't have a flashlight on him. He didn't have a source of light. There was not a video camera rolling. If there was a video camera rolling, it wouldn't have caught it anyways because Jeff dropped the flashlight. We'll get into how it could have been faked as well, but let's just go with what their account of the situation was. So Gary can kind of make out the shape of Jeff in the dark because he was wearing a white t-shirt, and you could just kind of see that he was standing at a weird angle. He's like, that's odd. So the only thing he has on him is a camera, which has a flash. So he's like, oh, here's a source of light. So that's the reason there's a picture of this. So he snapped two pictures, and those are the only two pictures we have of this scenario. He snapped those pictures because that was his source of light. He used one just to see what the hell was going on. And then he snapped the second picture when he was a little bit closer to see where exactly he was. Then he kind of hoisted up his legs to help him get himself untied. And Jeff was in a daze. He said he didn't really remember much. The only thing he remembers from that situation was feeling the rope around his neck and seeing the camera flashes. And other than that, he doesn't know, but he's saying that or once they loosened the...
What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, The Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology, now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with a city on edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorindi returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Dawn Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detectives shaken, to find the South Side Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, The Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, The Scare on Prime Video, now streaming.
Yeah, I think it was like a clothesline. Once they loosened that a little bit, then he felt something else tugging on his legs, trying to pull him down as if it was still trying to kill him. So that's their account of it. Then they get down. When he gets down, he's still got the rope around his neck, like Jussie Smollett or something like that. So it looks like nonsense. You know what I mean? Where it's like, dude, take that thing off your neck. But he had the welts around his neck and everything. But again, is that because a ghost did it to you, or is it because you did it to yourself? You're going to get injured if you do that to yourself. So from the side of things.
In fairness, right? Like if you're in the attic, you can't be like, all right, Jeff, you got to just hang there for a second. I'm going to go set up a camera so that people can see what we're seeing before I help.
Yeah, exactly.
Out, right. Yeah. Like you're going to help them. But my issue is it's from a nail. It's like, is this a railroad nail? Like what is this nail that a human is hanging from?
To be fair, I don't know if his feet were off the ground, maybe a little bit, but he seemed to be like kind of climbed up on that slanted post. And he was kind of perched on it, and the the thing was around his neck and it was hanging on a nail right there. So it seemed like something where, had they not documented every item that was in that attic and filmed and photographed the attic a million times before, in theory, they should have noticed that thing there. But if it was there and if it was pitch black and it's just Jeff walking around with a flashlight, maybe it could have looped around his neck and he didn't notice or whatever, or it was a ghost. Skeptic side of me.
Jeff in some bubble wrap.
Yeah. Jeff needs to be protected at all costs. But for me, when I first saw that picture, I'm like, dude, what a clown. Like he certainly just did that for the footage. But, you know, there wasn't a video going at the same time. Gary was just climbing up there with his camera to snap a picture. So it just seemed like kind of a weird risk to take, if you will. But he wasn't hanging like, you know, with 6 feet above the ground or anything like that. But
wait, so was he up there by himself as when the rope tied itself around his neck?
I think so. Either Gary had just gotten up there or Gary was on his way down or something like that. And then he heard Jeff scream. So he kind of scrambled his way back up, but there was no light. So it's like either it was a poorly planned situation with no video cameras rolling, no source of light to show that he was hanging, or it was something paranormal, or it was just an accident that seemed like something paranormal because, again, mass hysteria, guy gets his head stuck in a loop and they're like, oh, it must have been the ghost.
Clearly not trained and ready professionals like us. Just prepared for every situation at all times when we go investigate places.
None of us have ever almost been killed by a shoelace on an investigation.
Yet.
Surprisingly enough.
Just wait till you go to sleep on our next one. But now we're screwed. Like, if it ever does happen, especially to you, Dave, people are like, Rob threatened him on episode 115. Like, no one's ever going to believe it.
Rob threatened Dave on pretty much every episode we've ever had. If anything ever happens, be like, yeah, Rob finally saw the opportunity and took it during an investigation.
It was the ghost. Yeah, if a demon ever attached itself to me or to Dave and took him out, I am getting blamed 100% for it.
Absolutely, yeah. As you should. You can't just
I shouldn't. Not if a demon takes him out. Not if a demon actually takes him out. But Dave, if you actually, although you'd probably be actually hanging from the nail.
Nancy says Taft never struck me as a faker, and he has a good reputation, not like some other TV personalities. I don't think we're saying that Barry Taft is a faker. We're not even saying that we think any of these guys are fakers. I think it's a little odd, this shoelace situation, but that wasn't Barry. That was Jeff.
Exactly. It wasn't Barry or Gary. It was Jeff.
Or Larry. Or
wasn't
Mary.
Larry either. Wasn't Larry either. But
it was the only guy without an Ari name.
Right.
Coincidence.
My actual thoughts on this is it's either an accident or something paranormal. I don't think he planned it out, because you have to be an idiot to plan something out that poorly without a camera rolling, not even knowing if there's another guy up in the attic with you, and hurting yourself. So, and potentially if it's a dark attic and he's perched up on this thing, he could have accidentally killed himself there. So I don't think he faked it. I think it was either an accident, either they didn't notice the clothesline hanging there, or it could have been an insane paranormal attack. But my first initial reaction, like I said, years ago when I first saw it, was I thought this guy was an absolute clown and I thought it was being faked. But I've, after reviewing the rest of the footage and seeing the full documentary and diving into the rest of the story, I think it was either accidental or paranormal. That's kind of where I'm at on it.
If you go back to the Villisca House episode, right, and we talked about the people that would go into that, whether it was the attic or the bedroom, and they would feel like compelled to hurt themselves, and got to a point where one person actually stabbed himself. I wonder if it would be something like that, where he was persuaded to wrap it around his own neck by whatever spirit was up there.
That's actually a really good point, which I hate admitting, but I do like that point.
But you can't rule it out, because he did his account on that situation is he basically blacked out for a few moments and he doesn't really know what happened. And then he remembers seeing the camera flash and stuff, but that could be a possibility. Maybe it was. I mean, it's definitely something evil up there, right? It's definitely something horrible. You get the blood. That's still such a weird part of the story. Yeah, you get the shadow figures, the light anomalies. And then all of a sudden the baby has this red mark on its forehead. And it seems like Jackie had been dealing with that a lot, not necessarily the mark on the forehead, but whenever this thing made its presence known, whether it was through the blood seeping through the walls or marks that show up on the walls, it was spelling out her name. She would always, her first instinct was, I'm not going to let you get to me and I'm going to get rid of it. So she would always either paint over it or wipe it away. When it came to the baby, she immediately was like, don't touch my baby, and wiped it off. And then you have everybody standing around and all of a sudden then they all go quiet and you hear in the documentary, you hear the big footsteps going on above them. And it was very clear. It was just this knock, 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 knock. Like someone is like angrily stomping around that attic. So really cool footage. And you do have the video of it. It's not just photo. You know, for the attic situation with the hanging, you only got the photos because that's all they had up there. But you get the video of him coming down. You get the audio of him screaming and stuff. So you can kind of see it in real time. And it definitely adds a layer of authenticity to this story. And again, this is just the beginning of it. So it keeps going from there.
But like Jesse said earlier, they believe that there's multiple spirits there. So one could be demonic. Well, could just be very malevolent, because isn't the theory that, and I don't, you stop me if I'm jumping too far ahead, the theory that the two spirits was one person who was murdered and also the murderer?
Yes. So that's okay, because we've told the whole story anyway, so we could jump into that. So they think the guy who was murdered was, I have a name here, I had the name somewhere, I lost the name. It was something Henderson, I believe. And hang on one second, let me see if I can.
While you look at that, Papa Squatch says, I wonder if there were aspects of an actual haunting, but also playing it up to sell videos. This is every single poltergeist case ever. They start out with some realistic hauntings. You saw this in Enfield, and you saw it on Lindley Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And there's actual paranormal things going on, but the people who are involved under all of the pressure almost feel like they have to perform for people who are watching, because you know the eyes, those cases get so big that they just feel like they have to do stuff. And that's, you saw that in Enfield, you saw it in Lindley Street, you may have seen it here. We're going to see it next week when we cover another poltergeist.
Hey, there we go. So the guy's name was, so they went back to the library or whatever, they looked into the archives and they found a newspaper clipping from this guy's death. His name was Herman Hendrickson, and he was found under the wharf in 1930, not far from the San Pedro house. This was, so when they started doing the Ouija board stuff in the trailer, he was saying that he had his head held underwater. When they checked the death certificate, it seemed to add up with, there was foul play involved. So it wasn't just a regular drowning. They think he was held under. So I think the Ouija board had said suffocation or something, but could have been a drowning where they held him under, kind of the same idea. And they think this is the second ghost in the house. And the first ghost was likely his killer. They think it might've been, I had one source that said John Damon, but then when watching the documentary, they didn't mention it. So that might be just completely wrong from one of the sources. They think one of them could have been the killer. I don't know if this is this John Damon guy. That sounds unlikely. I think that the account of John Damon was just, he was someone who actually lived at the property and maybe had died in the house. So I wouldn't go ahead and just start calling this guy a murderer. Rest in peace, John Damon. I don't think that's the killer, but the ghost number one was probably this guy, Herman. It was in the area where he died. I think that's kind of a loose connection that you could have tied to it, but could have been him or somebody else that either got suffocated or drowned. You're kind of basing that off of evidence collected from the Ouija board. And then the other one would be his killer. And apparently the reason that this thing was targeting Jeff was because Jeff resembled the killer. And it kind of makes me think of the Amityville case where you had DeFeo and the next family that moved in, the husband looked just like him, kind of. It was weird, yeah. Kind of a weird part of that story. And that's obviously an even more controversial one, in my opinion. But this one, the evidence from this one is also controversial for a different reason. But
what a they're always controversial.
A lot of guys in the 80s did look alike, right? Everyone had that same look. Meanwhile, we're talking about that while we all are dressed exactly the same with the same style of beard. We're like, oh, these guys in the 80s weren't very
looking different.
Yeah. Did they even try wearing all black with a backwards hat and a beard?
With their booty shorts and cutoff jeans and black jackets.
So people can only see the top half of us. We're also wearing booty shorts, cutoff jeans. That's what's on the lower half. So
I mean, that's required by our uniform. That's
booty shorts over the jeans, as is tradition.
Oh, of course. How else would you wear them? Moving on. So then she moves to the trailer. She had enough and they moved off and they thought that this was going to calm down. And it just didn't. It didn't. Almost right away, she started noticing a haunting. They had some friends over that were helping her move this big old TV. You guys know these old TVs, when they're big and when you're in the early 90s, you're going to need some friends to help you move those TVs. They are large. Yeah. But as they were moving out, it was actually in the TV screen. Obviously, it's powered off. It was in the shed. And they were moving it, I believe, out of the shed, either into the house or just throwing it away or whatever.
With a forklift.
Yeah, basically. And they had seen, and they testified to this, or they weren't in court, but they gave their recap of the story on this documentary. They saw this face of the old man show up in the TV screen, kind of in like the top left corner. And they described it as the same face as that bloody disembodied head that she had, that Jackie had seen back at her original house. And there was no reflection. There was no old man just standing there in the yard. It was just out of nowhere. And that freaked him out. And then I think it was later that night, or I would have dropped it. That would have looked for any excuse to drop it.
That might have been their excuse to drop it. One of the guys saw it. He dropped aside, and instead of trying to
instead of owning up to just being weak, just like, I saw a ghost.
And it being feeble. He's just like, there was a ghost in the TV. That's why I had to drop it.
We're going to have to smash it into pieces and haul it away. So that was that. And then I think it was later that night, or like in the next few days or whatever, they started hearing this pounding from the shed. And it wasn't just Jackie who was hearing it. Again, this was new neighbors who may have not even known the stories that had happened at a previous house, but they would hear just this absolute slamming inside of the shed that sounded like somebody was trying to break out of it. And if I were a neighbor, I'd be like, hey, who is in your shed? They had this shed ghost, and basically they bring the team back in and they start filming the shed. And the first thing that happens is they notice that the camera had shifted positions and was looking directly at them. And for some reason, of all the terrifying things that happened in the story, that one was like the creepiest detail. I don't know why. So they had the camera pointing in the shed. They go back into the house in the other direction. And they said like 15 to 20 minutes later, they take a look outside and the camera is no longer pointing in the shed. It's just looking right at them. I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. You know, like that. I don't know why that would freak me out so much, but they're like, that's strange. It's almost like it doesn't want to be on camera there. Maybe it's sick of being on camera, but it was a friction lock mechanism. It was something that was like, you would have had to manually go out there and loosen it up to adjust it and let it turn. It wasn't something that the wind could have done. It wasn't something that someone could have accidentally bumped with their elbow when they were walking by. So that was just another piece of evidence. So they got that. And then they start the Ouija board sessions. And it sounds like a crazy thing to do at this step in the story, but this was their answer. And they're like, we're going to try to find out who this is. Who are we communicating with? And how do we move on from this? And while the Ouija board sessions went absolutely nuts, you had more attacks. You had Jeff get lifted up and thrown against a wall. They said he levitated and got tossed against the trailer wall so hard that it shook this whole trailer, which doesn't sound like it would be that hard to do.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
But at the same time, like, you could feel that force. And they said it wasn't something where he could have just kicked back in his chair. They all said, and this included a new witness, the babysitter, and you had Jackie there, you had Barry, probably Gary, Larry, and Harry too. And they said that so much. They said they witnessed him levitate and get thrown backwards into the wall. Now, we've dealt with these situations in so many different haunted places. We explain it ad nauseum. We are annoyed by this occurrence that happens at haunted places when hauntings are going on. But yes, cameras do die. And yes, it sounds super conveniently fishy, doesn't it? Where it's like, oh, well, why weren't the cameras rolling? Because the cameras kept dying. Unfortunately, I can attest to this, and we can't debunk this as a reason to put out nonsense in the newspapers or make your story blow up. This happens at haunted places. It really does. And
too much.
Annoying. Drives me insane. So that could have absolutely been a thing. Yes, it sounds convenient if you are making up this story, but I don't think they made up this whole story. And it's not like all of these witnesses have disappeared and are afraid to tell their story. Or at least back in the 1990s, they weren't afraid to tell their story. And I listened to an interview, I think it was like 4 or 5 years old, with Barry Conrad, where he's still vouching for this story. So it's not something that people, as far as I know, are now debunking. It seems like everyone has stuck to their guns, and the list of witnesses did not shrink. The list of witnesses continued to grow. So there's something there that is to be taken away from this. But Ouija board sessions, crazy attacks happened. They said that the candles were being blown out and then reigniting, kind of a cool thing there. They had objects that were moving around and flying around during this situation as well. And then once they got the answers, it seems like the haunting actually finally started to die down. But that's not the end of the story. It just keeps going. So what I didn't mention in the episode,
Ouija board thing, because when we mention Ouija boards, a lot of people say, what the heck are they doing with a Ouija board? You're going to make the situation worse. There are two schools of thought with differing opinions on Ouija boards. You have the religious side of it, which they believe that a Ouija board is a direct channel to the devil. And if you use it at all, you can conjure negative spirits. And then there are people who are involved with the occult who believe that it is literally just a tool to contact the dead, not necessarily an evil spirit, but any spirit. So people believe it's good. Other people believe it's bad. So I think this actually kind of sounds like a situation where it may have, if anything, resolved it or helped resolve it.
It could have been that, or when she moved out of that trailer, she went to the next place and then she brought priests in. The priest blessed the new location, which I guess was really close to San Pedro, and they had blessed the new house, but she said the hauntings were still there. She caught orbs on camera. She included some of the pictures in the documentary. And so it sounded like, I mean, if it's just down to orbs and it's no longer things going absolutely crazy, then that's fine. But I do want to jump, before we wrap, I do want to jump into a couple of the hauntings that happened at Jeff's apartment. It might've been Barry's apartment, but I'm pretty sure it was Jeff's. It might've been both. Some of these hauntings were pretty crazy. So there was a lot of poltergeist activity going on there. One of those things was it kept turning on the stove and it was kind of cool. So this is stuff that's also on film. But it was very dangerous the way that this would happen. Obviously turning on a stove is pretty dangerous, but it was particularly the front right burner, which seems to be everyone's kind of favorite burner. It's either front right or front right or front left, right? What's your go-to? You go back left? You belong in a mental institution.
Well, first of all, I'm left-handed.
Oh, disgusting.
Which makes me use the stove properly.
Back left. That's the weakest one on my stove. And you're the weakest person I know. Dave, which one do you go for?
Front right, usually.
Front right, okay.
I always go vegetables on the back burners.
No pot, right. Pan, just vegetables straight on the burner.
Yeah, it's like I have one of those electric flat top stoves, so it works like a hibachi grill. Just turn on all four burners.
Psychopath. But things got kind of scary with this. It wasn't just about the fumes coming off the stove or anything like that. Like they were noticing it right away, and they were filming while this was happening, and they'd go back and forth, and the burner would be on again.
Matthew Thomas says back burner when you have kids. But we all know Rob has no family, so not the case. That's
right. Nothing to worry about.
I have kids.
No, you don't.
I have pets that are some say more important than kids. I agree, but I'm just saying.
That's what people who don't have kids say. But dogs also important. Your dog's big enough to jump up on the stove. I can condone you using the back burner. You don't want Gotham to burn his little paws, his dog hands, as some say.
Yeah, dog hands.
Most people don't say that, but this is where the situation got dangerous. So while there were burners turning on, at one point they heard a loud crash and they're like, what was that? It was in the kitchen. They go into the kitchen and there was a box of 22 caliber ammunition that had been smashed onto the stove, and a lot of the bullets spilled out onto the floor. But had they not, I don't think it would be recommended to put a box of ammunition on a burner. Probably not great.
Depends what you're trying to do.
Right. Yeah. So these bullets didn't manifest out of nowhere. This was Jeff's ammunition. He kept the rifle in the house, or I think it was actually Barry's house at that time. But either way, whoever it was, that was something obviously very concerning, because had they not seen that right away, who knows what could have happened? Some sort of explosion or bullets flying around, or however he would react to gunpowder, usually bang. Right. So they had that going on, and they had this weird situation where things kept getting flipped upside down. So they would open the fridge and all of the condiments would be like flipped upside down, which sounds a little goofy until you experience it. Right. So ketchup, mustard, mayo, whatever, everything's flipped upside down in the kitchen. So they'd turn it back. And then I guess it was also happening in the shower, where shampoo bottles were also getting flipped upside down. Very strange.
Is it? Do you guys not put your condiments upside down and your shampoo bottles upside down?
This is going to be like a left-handed thing. Like someone who's left-handed has to put all their condiments and shampoo bottles upside down so they can use it correctly.
No, you do that so it drips to the top, so it's easier to squeeze out.
Yeah, and then especially with ketchup, because ketchup, otherwise you get the ketchup jizz, like the white, you know, gross gooey stuff. If you have it upside down, you don't get that when you squirt it out.
We are elite. We don't eat ketchup.
Yeah,
you don't eat ketchup with French fries?
Maybe with French fries.
barbecue sauce.
Eggs?
Jesus Christ. We're going to have to end the show here. This is, I can't believe we're finding out something.
I almost sent one of my kids to an orphanage the other day because he squirted ketchup on his chicken sandwich.
Oh, man. That's like one of the only times I will never send food back at a restaurant. It's not in my DNA. And I'm definitely not going to drive back if I went through a drive-through. But that happened at Wendy's. I went and I got like the crispy chicken sandwich or whatever. And I ordered my son a cheeseburger. I'm like, only ketchup on the cheeseburger. So like, crispy chicken sandwich, only ketchup. I'm like, no. Please, crispy chicken sandwich, the way you make it, lettuce, mayo, tomato, and the cheeseburger is only ketchup. And I could just tell she isn't listening to me. She's like, yep, okay, yep, second window. I'm like, God, she didn't listen. And of course, as I'm driving away, I take a bite out of the kitchen sandwich, just ketchup on it. I'm like, oh. And I don't drive back because I'm not that kind of guy.
You didn't finish
it. But I also, I didn't eat it now.
No, you can't. That's gross.
Yep. Not good. So, offensive. I'm sorry to end this with such a sad story. But that's my chicken sandwich story with the ketchup. God, still hurts me. Do you hear the pain in my voice when I tell that story? Absolutely unacceptable. So there is a lot more to this. You can go watch the documentary yourself or look it up. A lot of sources get a lot of things wrong with this story. They get names mixed up. They get places mixed up. I probably got a few things mixed up, so don't come at me if I got a few things wrong here or there. San Pedro people, don't get mad at me about Pedro, okay?
I'm sure no one will ever say anything. No. It's just not what people do. People are understanding.
So this is a controversial story, obviously, and it is one with a lot of evidence and a lot of documented stuff. You do have more things that happened with this haunting. I could not get into all of it. It is such a deep, deep story. And it is a wild one. And if it's a true story, if everything here is a haunting, this is one of the most dangerous ghosts that we've dealt with without leaving a trail of dead bodies. So we've dealt with cursed objects that have a bigger body count, obviously. But with this one, the attack is one of the most serious ones that we've caught on film, at least, or caught pictures of. So anyways, do we have some reviews we want to hop into?
Yeah, we have quite a few 5-star reviews to get to. Also, I do want to apologize about your sandwich. That is absolutely disgusting that they put ketchup on it.
I just can't.
The way you properly order a chicken sandwich is with light mayo only, and then you dip it in the ketchup after.
Such a piece of shit. I will fucking kill you. I will drive to your house and murder you.
When we were in Pennsylvania last year, Rob and I went out to get breakfast, and I literally watched him squirt ketchup on breakfast sausage, and I almost left. I almost left the restaurant.
Had to be done. So the first review was from Sea Candy, titled "Not Too Spooky," and then just simply says "Perfect amount of spooky." So short, simple, to the point. Thank you, Sea Candy. This one is from Nathan's Girl, titled "Love This Show." I listen to a decent amount of podcasts, but this one is my favorite. I not only love the content, but I love the banter between you three. Easy to listen to with great stories, and I look forward to every episode. Thank you for putting so much time and effort into these shows. Rob's voice is so soothing, and I love his storytelling. You're all awesome, and I appreciate you and all the research you do.
Your voice is not soothing when you're talking about food.
Don't worry.
It's nauseating.
This one's from NY-NC, titled "Freaking Awesome." I am not sure how I found this podcast, which reminds me, I have a challenge for our listeners. Your challenge is to tell your friends about our show this week. I'm not sure how I found this podcast 2 weeks ago, but I have been binging ever since. I love history and, of course, Ghost. These guys do a great job with their research. The banter is hilarious. I find myself laughing out loud quite often. I also decided to add them to my Patreon because they are that great. Awesome job, guys. Thank you so much. And the last one is from LOL Trash, titled "Best Podcast Ever." Literally waiting every Tuesday.
Made me nervous for a second.
Yeah.
Their name was LOL Trash. They titled it "Best Podcast Ever." Literally waiting every Tuesday to listen to your podcast. It's part of my daily routine. At this point, hands down, the best group of guys, except Rob, LOL.
See, it started off with the name. I was like, this is not going to be great. Then it started off, got good, then it got better.
Yeah, then it turned into Astral Trash by the end. So,
see, I thought it was a happy ending.
I'm sure you did.
Absolutely. All right, let's thank our patrons real quick. For our VIPs, we have Dave D, we have Kate and Steve M, Blazora, Glitter Tease, Cammy from Washington, Kelly C, who, oh, we almost forgot to mention that this episode is dedicated to Kelly C. So, Kelly Costa, thank you so much for being a VIP patron. We almost forgot to mention who this was dedicated to, but we had so much to discuss. Ketchup on chicken sandwiches and stuff like that. But Kelly C, thank you so much. And thank you for being a VIP. Jennifer P, Dakota G, Nick, Donnie N, Inspires Gaming. We also have Allison V, Robert H, Anna C, J9, Mallory K, Demon King, Mom and Pops W, Lisa J, and Watching a Family on Netflix, Get Rob's Pinky. All right. Thank you so much for being VIPs. Next up, we're going to jump into the Warren's Wards. And let's kick that off with I only take calls from my Ouija board. Nefarious Chad Poles, Wahini Pirate, I Hate Rob, Julie Gooley, Eugene M, Arcade Hunters, Siobhan Not Sharon, Kath Q, Liz Young, DC, Chris Connolly, LBPS Founder, Next HTGS Guest, The Other Rachel B, Sarah Cook, Stitch Kitten, Ambi Rose, Janice G, Lily, Rachel B, Rob's left-handed dog, Hands with Man. Damn, that's tough to read. Rob, left-handed dog, Hands the Man Blood on Them. We have Sydney, the entomologist bee, Papa Squatch. Surgery sucks, but you guys don't. Okay. So, Steph, I read this as surgery sucks, but you guys don't see. And I'm like, turns out we're blind. But no, it's a little punctuation thing here. Surgery sucks, but you guys don't see, y'all. Steph A. There we go. And
get well soon, Steph.
Yeah, shout out to recovery. Steph A.
Hell yeah, always a legend. We appreciate that. We also have Stan, the man with the ham hands, and loving it. Thank you guys so much for being part of the Warren's Wards. Next up, let's jump into the Ghost Pirate Mafia, kicking it off with Michelle. We have Niroku. We have Rachel G. Too many Rachel B's. She's starting the revolution. I love it. Cold Warrior, the last worm Rob used for fishing. Insert vague reference from a missed live stream. D from H-Town, Meta Oos, Sarah B, Dominica, Queen Chan's Revenge, Angel prefers Jesse than Rob. Thank you, Angel.
Wow.
The Monster Mom 04, Shannon Fuck K, Allie Dark Snark. A skunk sat on a stump and thunk the stump stunk, but the stump thunk the skunk stunk. How the hell did I do that? Boom.
Remember that was definitely constructed just to make you slip up.
Yeah,
and you
nailed it. I remember like last week when I messed up my own last name. Megan S, Morgan S, Mark Twain and the Haunted Grape, Sharon V, Wayne C, white ketchup jazz dripping off my chicken. Thank you for making that jazz, Nancy. Crystal Quinn, Aaron A, Mina H, Colby, the unnamed serial killer, Rob Coakley, allegedly poorly ketchup jizz bukkake french fry party.
Thanks for not making that.
We have to start putting like, it's time to shut this podcast off now. If you have kids warnings right before we read this list, we have Alicia E. We have John Damon. Finger of John Knightman. You're the champion of this podcast. And
no, it's that's an Always Sunny reference. Do it again.
Is it?
Do it again.
John Damon. I know this one. Yeah. Yeah. I know exactly the reference. It's the song, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, hell yeah.
Let's
John Damon. Fighter of John Nightman. You're the champion of this podcast and hauntings for everyone. Cat Scratcher Creeper Peeper. Hometown Ghost Stories Booty Shorts coming soon. Sam from the Paul. Joe, basements aren't a thing here in Australia. Paul from St. Louis, Al Capone, Huggy Bear, Rob Capone's alleged I like that. Rob Capone's allegedly poorly taxidermied pickled weenie. I like Rob Capone. That's fun. Solar Flare, Mariah M, Kiralee J, Anthony, Rob sucks on toes. Don't let him fool you. T, Cody G, Brandon W, Hooper the Hellhound, Soph, and Jesso Bavid Coklikins.
It's actually Rossi Cokins, if you guys were wondering.
No, that's just me and you. We got to include Dave. So that's why I get.
No, we don't.
Yes, Jesso Bavid. Just Jessobavid. There we go. Thank you guys so much for being part of Patreon. That was a tough one. I guess the toughest time I've had, but it's always appreciated and always fun. So we do thank you guys for tuning in. We'll be back on Friday. We're going to review. Oh, what is Friday?
No, that's Friday is it's the Ghost in the paranormal news. Current events, and there are some. It's definitely going to be listenable via podcast. We describe everything, but I would definitely check out the video on this one because there is some footage on here that is like crazy. We were all kind of taken aback by it, so.
Was good check stuff. Out. Check yes, that there are some out. Good ones. And then if you want to catch up on the movies that we are covering the original Alien movie. So definitely go check that out and watch that if you haven't already. I mean, it's a super old movie, so there will be spoilers, but like I said, it's old. So anyways, thank you guys, and we'll catch you next week for another Poltergeist story.
South London.
Ooh. Ooh. Very good. Get ready for some accents on that one. I'm excited for it. We'll talk to you guys soon. Thank you so much.